Does music help when you're in the ICU?
If you've survived cancer as a child, what can you expect later on?
Can we predict who's going to have a flare-up of their COPD?
And an update on the severe respiratory illness that's been reported in the Middle East.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly roundup of medical news from Johns Hopkins, posted on June 14th, 2013. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
And on the fly, as usual, I should say, so on the phone this week. Rick, why don't we start with this issue that is very close to my heart. That's the idea that if we play music to folks in the ICU, it may improve their outcomes. That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
Well, let me set up the environment, Elizabeth, and I'll let you run with it. People that are in the ICU and on a mechanical ventilator, it's pretty disturbing and pretty anxiety-provoking. You have this tube in your throat that can be uncomfortable. You're worried about your illness, you're worried about being on a ventilator, but you know there's not a whole lot you can do about it. What do? Is we put those patients on sedatives and analgesics to try to calm them down. But they're associated with side effects like low heart rate, low blood pressure. They can cause constipation, and they actually don't give the patient any control over the situation. So it's not ideal. So let me hand it over to you. Why might music intervention be helpful?
Well, of course, we know that when people listen to music, particularly music that they really like, that it kind of calms them down. It slows things down. If we take a look at brain waves in those folks, we find out it's quite beneficial. So to me, it makes a lot of sense that it would be helpful in this particular situation.
The other thing that's also attractive, it can be patient-directed. So this was a study conducted in 373 patients that were hospitalized in the ICU, and they were randomized to one of three treatments, either just the usual care. A third of patients received noise-canceling headphones, and a third of patients were able to do patient-directed music, headphones near them, music that had been selected by them, and they could apply it when needed. And the outcomes were the patients less anxious? Did it reduce their sedative use? And what they found out is on the fifth day, that was the day where all these measures were assessed, individuals that were randomized to the patient-directed music group had fewer sedative doses, 38%, and 36% less anxious, according to a scale that was used.
Something that's easy to implement and that is very specific and individually directed doesn't interfere with anything else that's going on. To me, this sounds like a win-win.
I agree. It's inexpensive. It doesn't bother what the nurse is doing. I think there's a lot of potential in it. The only problem is it's probably applicable to a small number of ICU patients. So these were patients that had to be conscious, and in all the patients they examined, only about 5% fell into that group.
Well, I think there's probably a fairly persuasive argument to be made for the application of music, even in people who are apparently unconscious, and we know that even from studies in ORs.
It's a little bit harder to gauge success for that. This was a very clean study in that the patient was able to say, gosh, I'm less anxious, and the nurse could say, yeah, they use less sedatives.
I, for one, would like to see it expanded into other folks, and I guess we'll just wait and see on that one. Since we're in the Journal of the American Medical Association, then, why don't we turn to something that I think is really important? We have this huge success story with regard to the treatment of childhood cancers. Everyone is uplifted by the fact that there's so much survival. But when we look down the road, we find out that there's a lot going on as these people age into adulthood.
And that's the value of this particular study. And they looked at the long-term outcome of individuals that have survived childhood cancer. And as you mentioned, we're becoming much better at treating childhood cancers. And most of those fall into the classification of leukemias and lymphomas. And in this particular study, the average age of treatment is about 6 years. And they followed the patients up about 24 years later. So they had accumulated over 1,700 adults, average age of 32, who were survivors of childhood cancer. They were enrolled in what's called the St. Jude Lifetime Cohort Study. They did annual testing, blood tests and EKGs, but they also did specific assessment based upon what kind of cancer therapy they got. For example, if someone got radiation therapy to the chest, they made sure that those women got mammograms. If someone had a particular chemotherapeutic agent which could affect the heart, they made sure those people had routine echoes. And what they discovered may be surprising to most individuals. When they looked at these relatively young individuals, 98% of them ended up with one or more chronic health conditions, with about two-thirds of them having a severe, disabling, or life-threatening condition. This means that once you've survived childhood cancer treatment, we need to do continued surveillance over the ensuing decades.
Clearly, we modify cancer treatment all the time. And one of the things I thought of when I looked at this study was, okay, what was implemented in those folks 30 years ago or 20 years ago, we modify that all of the time and we target therapies much more specifically. So hopefully we'll be able to ameliorate some of these side effects because, gosh, I mean, some of these consequences of treatment were really pretty profound.
They were, Elizabeth. Even though we're trying new therapies and they're getting better, still many of the old therapies are still used in combination with the newer ones. One of the nice things about this particular study is that about 50% of these problems were found not because the patient had symptoms related to it, but because there was routine surveillance done. Really need to have long-term follow-up.
I think that's the most positive take-home message we can possibly give out of this study, because, of course, the other one is don't have therapy for your cancer when you're a kid. Maybe not. Even though there are sequela, we are going to have to tolerate those and just be vigilant about it.
I think that's great advice. I'm glad you put it that way.
Thank you. So let's turn from here then to something that's really quite concerning. The emergence of a pretty severe respiratory virus in the Middle East. That's in Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report.
And this is an update to better understand this public health risk that's been associated with what is now known as the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome Coronavirus, or the MERS virus. And it was first reported to cause human infection in September of 2012. And this was an update to give us information up to last week, at which time there have been 55 reported cases. And the concerning thing is that the mortality has been very high, 56% mortality. Currently, all the infections have been linked to one of four Middle Eastern countries, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan, and the UAE. But it hasn't been confined to those countries. There are four other countries, the United Kingdom, Italy, France, and Tunisia, that have also reported cases, but they're from travelers who have come from the Middle East. All these patients have respiratory symptoms. The vast majority were very severe, so they're easy to recognize. But concerning now, there have been at least three cases when it's been relatively mild. The incubation period is longer than we originally thought. We usually thought it was about a week or a week and a half. Now we know that it goes up to at least 2 weeks. So what I'd like to tell our listeners is if they have traveled to the Middle East and come back with a respiratory illness, or they've been in contact with somebody that's traveled to the Middle East recently within the last 2 weeks, then this needs to at least be on the differential diagnosis or a consideration for evaluation.
Let's talk just a little bit about coronaviruses. This is, of course, a gigantic class of viruses that are implicated in respiratory illness and the so-called common cold. Do we have to get these things on the radar for interventions such as vaccination?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that we have a vaccination for this. You know, the previous coronavirus that raised a lot of interest is what's called SARS. And this is a SARS-like illness. It has a different term. We call it MERS because it's emerged in the Middle East, but for all practical purposes, it has very many of the similar characteristics of the SARS virus that was in Southeast Asia.
Good news, of course, that we're watching this particular virus emerge and make its way around and hopefully be able to contain it, much like the SARS virus was contained.
The concerning thing, though, is we're entering into the holy period for many Muslims, and so there'll be a lot of travel to the Middle East.
Okay, finally then, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine since we're talking about lung problems. Let's take a look at chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, and predicting acute exacerbations with inflammation.
We know that people that have COPD or emphysema may have exacerbations, that is worsening of their condition, that actually accelerates loss of lung function and it's associated with a worse survival. So we'd like to have some way of identifying which individuals are likely to have exacerbations and target their therapy. So this was an interesting hypothesis by these investigators saying, listen, we know that inflammation affects heart disease and golly gee, maybe can affect COPD as well. So they measured three routine measures of inflammation, a C-reactive protein, fibrinogen, they measured a leukocyte. And then they asked a simple question. For people that had exacerbations, did the presence of inflammation predict that? And what they found is that is in fact the case. If you just had one of those factors elevated, it just about doubled your risk. If you had two factors elevated, it increased it by about two or threefold. If you had all three elevated, you're about four times more likely to have an exacerbation.
Wow. These are just such routine tests.
A couple other nice things about it, it predicted exacerbations even in people that had mild symptoms and in people that had not had an exacerbation before. So if you can identify these individuals with a better predictive tool, like these inflammatory markers, then we can decide whether therapies can help prevent exacerbations.
Excellent. With regard to the blog this week, Rick, I have to tell you that I'm really struggling here because I love the music therapy in the ICU, but I think that the health outcomes in adults who've been treated for childhood cancer is very important. The coronavirus, of course, is another one. So I'm going to drop this into your lap and let you decide.
It's going to be difficult. One of the things we need to tell our listeners is that we'll put links to all of the articles on our blog site. But in deference to you, I know how much you like music therapy. Let's go ahead and go with that one. And perhaps you can put a catchy tune on.
Okay, so that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.